Hello friends, we have come to chapter number 14. Chapter number 14 is actually addressing recent or modern trends in management. Modern trends in management. In fact, this chapter is predominantly talking about the processes that have happened in the last about a decade or so. It was there for quite some time, about 20 years or so, but what has happened is recently the momentum has increased. Most of the things I'll be discussing in this chapter is all about the manufacturing trends, which is also permeated into the service sector as well. Now, when we say modern trends in management, we are talking about the way management paradigms have changed. Newer thought processes have come. In the earlier days, when we took the journey in this subject, principles of management, we talked about the Industrial Revolution. We talked about the scientific management process by Peter Drucker and other people. And that has been the basis of any management process anywhere in the world for a long time. Now, today, when you guys are listening to this particular lecture, you know that organizations are not run the way they used to be run some 30, 40 years back. Do we mean to say that the management principles are changed? Do we mean to say that the management principles are very different today? Certainly not. The point to be noted is management is an art and a science at the same time. And since it's an art and a science at the same time, it has to get adapted with changing times. We use the basics of management thinking as has been done for ages. But we need to modify with the present demands of the world. And hence, in the recent years, last about 20 years or so, these practices have become very, very popular. And they're all permeating into every sector, not only manufacturing sector. Now, with this brief introduction, I'd like to set the ball rolling by going over to the slide number one. It starts off by talking about globalization. This is a very common buzzword. Everybody knows about globalization. So, globalization of product and service markets offer a unique challenge to companies today. Now, let's understand globalization a little more clearer. Just because a product is available in any country doesn't make it global. Just because we have manufacturing units in certain countries doesn't make it global. There are certain prerequisites for something to become global. That's again covered in a separate area of study called world-class manufacturing. But what I would like to share with you is in globalization, there is a different approach towards managing companies, a very different approach. It is what I call it as expansive approach, expansive. Now, when I say expansive, I mean that when we talk about the earlier forms of management systems, wherein we say there's a unit which manufactures some, let's say, automobiles, and that unit is making the automobiles by having all the various management processes, planning, organizing, etc. It has a marketing department which goes and gets the demand for the automobile, and it does the selling, the sales department does the selling, and then we do the materials planning for everything, and all this is localized to one area. When this product, the cars become popular, they start getting popular outside the boundaries of the country to which they belong. Then they may go in for what is called as exports. Parent country is exporting to a foreign country. The manufacturing unit is still retained here. Now, whatever I'm creating here as a quality, whatever I'm creating here as production processes, they remain constant, uncontested. And then these cars are exported. So whatever cars you get in the foreign country is what you get. Obviously, common sense tells us, our modern way of thinking and consumption tells us that consumer should get what he wants. So when I'm exporting, I'm selling cars which are made by my standards, by my manufacturing processes. And by default, I am not willing to listen to any feedback. Feedback, if any, is tweaked, little bit of here and there. But I am not really going there and checking out what exactly they want, then come back and set up a manufacturing unit according to that, in most cases. So export. Now, gradually what happened was, organizations went to beyond the boundaries and they started exploiting the local resources. Meaning, if I go and set up a unit in, let's say, some part of Africa, so in that African country, whatever resources are available, human resources, machine, materials, etc., I use them. When I do that, what happens? I am contributing to the economy of that country and the growth also. So I'm not just going there for the business purpose of taking profits away from the land, but I'm also contributing to the growth of the land and the economy of the land. So gradually what happens is a manufacturing unit that is localized in one place, it starts spreading out to other countries, it crosses its own boundaries. And then what it does, it localizes it. And when it localizes it, it starts getting an idea about what should be what is called as a global quality and global norms of production and global norms of service. So when you go from culture to culture, country to country, you start realizing that there is something common in all mankind which people would expect. And that thought process is the cornerstone of any globalization, to my mind. So whether I talk about a Levi's jeans, or whether I talk about Coca-Cola, or I talk about a software services provided by Infosys or any other company, then the globalization aspect is all about being able to give something which is globally predictable, globally acceptable, globally as a benchmark. So when we talk about globalization, it's not about only setting up units abroad in different countries and catering to cross-country requirements, but it's much more than that. Okay, so the globalization of products and services, service markets offer a unique challenge to companies today. They're very unique. How unique are they? Let's understand. Globalization relates to the ability to develop and produce products and services for the regions of the world different from the home country. When a firm intends to go global, its objective is to leverage its size and knowledge to produce additional sales in the new market. When a company plans to go global, it wants to spread its wings. It wants to go and cater to the various regions of the world where there's a demand. Cater to the demand in the way they would like to have it, with slight modifications or maybe major modifications. Then the company has to go through its own, understand its size, to what size it is operating. It needs to have additional knowledge about many, many factors, cultural factors, factors of consumption patterns, factors about value systems in the society. So many things have to be done. It comes under a separate area called consumer research, global consumer research, right? Now, that being the case, once I understand that thing, it becomes a leverage. Leverage meaning a very small effort will bring about a major change. So that small effort needs to be understood in a very, very defined, proper manner by openness in thinking, by actually dropping your own thoughts and seeing what is there and listening carefully, by going and gauging what is going on in the world. And globalization is to be experienced initially before you become global. One has to go around and watch and see what's going on. One cannot go with assumptions. A particular car is a big hit in a particular country, so the same car will definitely sell in any country. It doesn't work that way. So one has to understand what are the common factors, at the same time, what are the local factors that come into picture. So we use a term called glocalization, G-L-O-C-A-L, glocal, global and local put together, right? Now this is a very important thing for a firm to get into if it thinks to go global. Taking it further, for many years, few companies regarded the manufacturing processes they employ as a source of competitive advantage. In the beginning, when we had the Industrial Revolution, the focus of economic growth was manufacturing. Set up lovely manufacturing processes, make them very perfect, see that everything and anything that is required for manufacturing is provided for. And once you provide those things, it was logically understood that they would succeed. So manufacturing was a focus of economic growth at one point of time in the history of business. Then what happened? The goals of the companies were cost reduction and improved utilization of labor and machinery. Ask any person from the older generation, ask any person who's worked in production long back, they'll tell you the focus of any production unit used to be cost reduction and improved utilization of labor and machinery. So an entire philosophy was born out of that. So even if I am going to be appointing a subcontractor to take some components from their machine, I will ensure that these factors are becoming the focus. So everywhere we talked about cost reduction, machine utilization, and ensuring that the labor was also properly paid and kept at the way it has to be kept for the production to happen, right? Now, further, taking it further, as global competitors began to dominate major industries such as automobiles, domestic appliances, consumer electronics, etc., managers started looking for the reasons for these companies to be successful. While India was still a closed economy, pre-1991, we have been exposed to some of these global products in bits and pieces. It used to come streaming inside stray once in a while. And it has been our experience to realize that those global products were standing out, not because they were coming from abroad, from a very advanced country, or not because, you know, they were having a very lovely advertising channel or something, but they were really good in many respects. And what used to happen is these people had a leverage advantage of dumping these products in countries which were yet to be developed, like us. So as global competitors began to dominate major industries, we start realizing what is it that made them successful? Why is it that an Indian consumer always likes to buy a certain cassette? Those days, cassettes were the sought after thing. A cassette like a National cassette or a TDK cassette used to come from, say, Far East or something. People used to clamor and pick it up. Imported, we used to use this word very often, right? And we used to wonder how come this is available everywhere in the world and how come these guys are different from us? One of the major things was a closed economy does not permit globalization. Post 1991, India has leapt into it's gone too far now, right? And post 1991, many of you youngsters who are listening to me will understand that you are living in a very free economy. Free expression, free type of interaction in the workplace, open to ideas, cross-pollination of ideas, all these things are very common today. And this happened only because we decided as an organization, as a country, to become liberal. Liberalization first came. That means we opened up the economy and allowed foreign direct investment to come in a trickle to begin with. As the days progressed, we found that we could handle it, and then gradually more and more FDIs came in. Today we can say that India is truly a global country, wherein we are allowing a lot of cross things happening and our own Indian companies are setting up global units elsewhere, right? Now, this is the starting point of it, wherein we realized that this was the case, but at that point of time, we could do nothing, we were helpless because of the way the country was run. And then it was observed that these companies adopted highly efficient operations, which enabled them to produce high quality, innovative products quickly. Numbers, at the same time quality. They had a leverage because they were advanced, and more importantly, the countries themselves had this openness and they were allowing and encouraging manufacturing units to flourish. You know, in India we suffered, I call it the license raj, with due respects to the sanctity of the license raj, but it had a snowballing effect. It told us that this much number of automobiles you should manufacture per month, not more. If you manufacture more, you get penalized. It sounded ridiculous for people from advanced countries, but that's the way our country ran. For right reasons or wrong is not the question. We are discussing about the importance of understanding what it means to be global. So now, today we are having an open economy where we say, okay, make more, sell more and flourish. But you can't make more and sell more and flourish unless you offer quality, unless you offer what people really want. So today we are tested not in a seller's market, but in a market where buyers are demanding what they want. And hence the paradigm is different. Gone are the days when I could manufacture anything and dump it on you. Today, the customer says, this is what I want. The consumer says, this is what I consume. And so we have to give him what he wants. So the trend in the management scene is slightly different. If I have to do my planning, organizing, etc. in my organization, it's not governed by my internal strength and weaknesses alone. It's actually governed by the opportunities and threats outside. To just take you back to that particular chapter where we discuss SWOT, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. There was a time when strength and weaknesses were first taken care of, and then we were addressing opportunities and threats. Today, if you look at it, we have to look at the opportunities and threats available outside, and then from there, we need to come inside and see how the S and W can be taken care of. Both are equally important, but my strengths and my weaknesses have to be available to face the opportunities and threats. Unlike a time when my strengths and weaknesses dictated what I'll be offering to the market. It's slightly different, right? And so it was observed that these companies adopted highly efficient operations which enabled them to produce high quality innovative products quickly. They were paramount, you know, many organizations. I can keep on naming them. Banks, for example, you know, we had credit card company, one of the biggest ones in the world. They were the ones who were globally everywhere, but they were all difficult to touch for a common man in India because they were global and we couldn't make things happen, right? Now, taking it further, processes emerge as the key competitive weapons required for success in global competition. So the shift happened from manufacturing units, manufacturing production processes into what we call it as overall processes. Now, what do you mean by overall processes? It means if I have to deliver a lecture, for example, I can create a plan to what to deliver by taking the script, the PowerPoint, etc., and I can deliver it. If I go process oriented, then I have to take into account the smaller part of it, nitty-gritty part of everything that I do, and fine-tune them so that practically everyone listening to you is, to me, would be able to get the subject properly. There can be a lecture which is created in a very structured manner and delivered. Subject is understood by some, but not by many. Today, when we talk about a global education system for that matter, we ensure that we are talking to those number of people who are culturally different from us by understanding what clicks in their mind when they listen to us. And so we need to customize our processes, those small steps which we tend to ignore otherwise, into a very well-defined operational management. When we do that, we understand that this is essential. Just to give you an example, you take a cell phone industry. In a cell phone industry, a certain type of a shape of a cell phone, of a mobile, is acceptable in certain regions of the world. Now, that particular cell phone company, if it has to market it globally, then it has to understand the needs of what shape suits in that particular country where they are marketing it. So a small thing like a shape, a feel, a touch, those are the nitty-gritty part of what would otherwise been ignored by people. So it is very essential for us to understand that processes matter, small things. And when we talk about processes, we talk about process refinement as well. A process that worked yesterday will not work today because the demands are different. Today we talk about processes as a buzzword. Please remember that everything that is working very well today may not work well tomorrow. So we are constantly on the hop. Constantly we are moving ahead. Constantly we are taking things ahead because we want to ensure that what the customer wants we are able to give. what has actually happened is, it's coming in the further slides. The customer is pulling what he wants, and we have to simply give it what he wants. If the customer says, I want a certain color, I want a certain shade, a certain texture, so be it. We need to provide it to him. Now, one may turn around and say, what if I do not provide? Old thinking. If you don't provide, fine, he'll go to someone else. You'll lose business. You'll be out of competition and out of the business itself. So today, we are at the mercy of the consumer. Now, when I say mercy, not a negative word, I mean that today we are truly tested in whatever we claim to be our skills and competencies. Organizations claim that we are this, we are that, we are brands, etc. So the consumer is today asking, okay, if you're a brand, prove it to me. What can you offer me? So before making a noise about who you are, first perform by creating processes. I would even go to the extent of saying, simply create processes, everything falls in place. You know, I use these two words very frequently, reputation versus brand. If I create good processes, my reputation builds up. Brands are something that is different. Brands are very temporary. Reputation is long lasting. Reputations have got values behind it. Brands also have value, but brands are again, you know, they are window dressed, they are covered, they are colored, and you know, they are given a beautiful window dressing and then presented to people. I may have a good brand image about myself, but do I have a reputation? Many companies in the world, brand is pretty good, but when you go closer, the processes are not good enough, and the reputation of the services that they are having is pathetic. So I would rather emphasize on reputation building, which is what many business houses are in the world. They build up a formidable reputation. One way of testing it is, the reputation, if a company has got a reputation, or even if a human being has got a reputation, it's known by how a third party who's not connected with him at all talks about him. Your reputation is known by the person who has heard about you, good things, and he talks about you even without knowing you. And when there's a critical mass of people who say, yes, this company is good or this person is good, that's reputation. Brand is something different. I'm not saying anything against brand. Don't take a wrong signal. The point is, brand is important, but does the brand come with a reputation backing? That's more important. Okay? So, many Japanese companies excelled in production function. They're coming to the Japanese movement, and the Japanese people set the trend for many, many global processes that happened subsequently. Right? So taking it further, work in manufacturing and operations will become more exciting and challenging in the years ahead. This is at the time of writing the book, but today this has become a way of life. Today we talk about a particular area called operations. We talk about operations, we don't talk about manufacturing alone. What's the difference? Manufacturing is all about this pointer I'm having in my hand has to be manufactured. So there are certain steps through which the manufacturing takes place. The raw material is brought from outside, it's put into the mold machine, this particular shape is molded, then we take the hardware, then there are some electrical fittings inside, there's a sensor here. So all these things would be assembled later on in the course of the assembly, manufacturing. In operations, I've got to ensure how it is being done in every stage, the process part of it. When I focus on the processes very, very minutely, refining them from time to time, I am into operations. Today we call ops, right? The very buzzword. So ops is important because ops tells us how well you are sensitive to the market requirements. How well you are sensitive to the market requirements. The operation guy who's servicing a customer has to have the global thinking in him, has to have the thinking in him saying that, look, by me not following a certain process step, I'm bringing down the reputation, the brand of my company. He must be having that consciousness. Very important. So when I talk about operations, I would say today this is a very, very important area which is being neglected. We have a lot of people operations, they talk about operations everywhere. But few people really understand that what I do as an operation person affects my company in a very big way. So today I could safely say that operations make or break an organization. A global organization is made or broken by the way it handles its operations. If the operations are not walking the talk of what the company claims, then it's a downslide. So how well processes are managed will decide whether the economics of the entire nation will improve or decline. Now it's on a macro level. If a company A, a company B, a company C, a company D, number of companies in a country are all having refined operations, they're focusing on the global customer, the requirements, constantly refining, then I'm sure all of us will agree that the economy of the land itself will improve drastically. And today, India is galloping towards that. We have yet to arrive, but we are galloping towards that. We are going towards that. A lot of things are happening today. Okay? So, to meet these challenges, manufacturing firms are now adopting new methods and are applying new technology. Technology has become a focus, better ways of doing things. From a manual, a small, simple, fundamental lathe machine in a manufacturing unit, we went to Swiss automates. Today we are into robotic manufacturing and God knows what next. So the technology becomes a leverage. When I have a technology, I have a leverage. And by this, we are adopting new methods of manufacturing. The man-machine interface at the workplace also has changed quite a lot. A person doesn't come to the workplace anymore saying that I'm working from 9 to 5, be done with it and I leave at 5. Well, there are some hours for working, no doubt. But he comes with a different attitude. The training itself has happened in such a way that he realizes that he's working in a global environment, a global factory, a global service center. And so the norms are different and the management practices obviously have to be different, right? In addition to this, companies are trying to gain or retain the market share by offering customers better value by improving product quality and achieving higher productivity. Today, what are we talking about? We are talking about retention of customers. In marketing, we have learned about the product life cycle, right? The product starts growing, it comes to the plateau phase, then it declines. Right? Now today what are we doing? We are saying, fine, we know that you want a different product. We'll see that whether we can offer it. And so they're constantly in touch with the customer. They don't say that, you know, fine, this is what we can make and take it or leave it. No more. So I retain the customer, the same customer who bought a fundamental cell phone ages ago, basic cell phone, I am able to retain him today by offering him a smartphone, something better than that and better than that and better than that, by offering technology and offering excitement and offering newer conveniences. Offering him something where he can globally move around. Offering something where it is globally uniform everywhere. Now this is a focus. Are we talking about large organizations only, friends? No. Any one of us, any one of you who's listening to me, who's having even a small business, you think you can become global or not? You need to simply adopt global practices, simple. When you adopt a global practice, friends, it doesn't matter whether you're having customers in US or in Japan or in Africa. All you need to do is to simply drive a few fundamentals which we'll be discussing now. Drive it in your business and everything falls in place. You're a global guy. I can give a number of examples and instances about small vendors in India whom I meet. Small companies, small establishments, even shops who are global. Now that may sound very funny and humorous for many of you, but the fact is they follow certain principles which we are talking about in this case. One important indicator for you to become global is open-mindedness. Open-mindedness and willingness to change and listen to what the world wants. Those of us who do this can understand global much better. Okay? So this is something which we talk. Here we talk about values, right? Now what is a value? A value is it's a convenience. Value and price, two things we always debate upon. Anything high price need not be of high value. Anything that is low price need not be of low value. Value is emotional to me. Value is something which I cherish. Value is a convenience for me. And value has got multiple dimensions. So today, consumers are expressing values in different forms. And when they express values in different forms, organizations, marketeers, and researchers have to understand that this is what they're looking for in tangibles. Value is abstract. I'll go and tell Mr. Jayesh, you know, that Jayesh, I want a good service. So Jayesh has to understand what is good service. Now good, I have to define good. I'm not defining good. I'll tell him in so many abstract terms. The point is that Jayesh will start offering me some services. At some point of time, I realize that he realizes that I am feeling more than joyful and this is what I want. And today, all of us know that when something is valuable, price is not a factor. Profitable companies operate when they offer value to people. Because for a person who buys a merchandise or a service, when he finds it's valuable, he wouldn't mind offering a price. Not that companies have to overprice their offerings, but I am just explaining the importance of understanding value and then pricing your product accordingly. Unfortunately, there are a lot of high-priced products and services in the market which are not adding value majorly to many people, and they get lost. They get lost. On the other hand, we have organizations and products, for that matter, who are operating from what is called as the scale of economies. They are reducing the pricing day by day on good quality because they are getting more numbers. And today we have a high competitiveness. Look at the way e-commerce is working today. In e-commerce, when you go to a site and you're going to buy some shirt or some other merchandise, you'll find that there's so much of competitiveness. And by now, all of you must have experienced at least one purchasing experience in the net. And you'll agree that, you know, the price and the quality both are pretty good. Not to talk about the timely delivery which some of them give, right? Now, taking this particular cue, this particular hint, this particular understanding, the focus of today's management process is on value. Gone are the days when you say that I manufacture, you consume. I know the processes, I am an R&D person, I am the creator, so you better take it. I am the expert. No. Today, what is it that is valuable to you? And I will make that and give you. So for that, the paradigm thinking has changed. I have to be open to what you want. I can't say that, okay, this is what it is and take it or leave it. No, it's very different, right? So let's take it further. Now I discuss an approach which most of us know already, what is called the JIT, just-in-time approach. It's very popular by now, by the time I'm talking about it to you. A JIT approach is a very simple common sense, to put it in a nutshell. I have prepared my table before I did the video shoot, right? Now, just in time means what? I need a few things as a support system for me. It comes exactly at the time before the shoot starts. What's the big idea? The idea is to ensure that the things that are required at the time of shoot, if they come on time, it serves a purpose. If it comes before time, one day before, and it's just kept here, is it a waste or not? Yes. Do I have to pay rentals for it or not? Yes. Do I have to pay the rentals for the space which it is occupying? Yes. So, when we say just in time, we are talking about just at the time when the process is about to start, we are getting the resources. Now, this is a little against the way conventional thinking goes. What does the conventional scientific management thinking say? It said, bring it in advance, do the inspection, store them, and then draw them into the production shop floor. Just in time says slightly different. It says do bring them, but bring them just in time. But then what about the contingencies? Somewhere along the line, the transporter might be meeting with an accident. Or there may be some other issues. It may not come on time. If I'm expecting it to come today, it may not come today. Something can go wrong. After it comes, I'll suddenly realize that the inspection is not properly done. So will it not be critical? Will it not create a problem in my production unit? The answer is yes. So what is just in time? In just in time, I have to ensure that all those things that were happening before will not happen anymore. A JIT will not work if all that inverted commas nonsense continues. It will work when every one of those things are properly addressed, process. The transporter who is coming to the factory to deliver the goods has to be trained, has to understand the importance of JIT. In turn, the subcontractor from where the components are coming should also be trained into what is JIT. It's a philosophy, it's a way of thinking. And all these people are the parts of what we call as a value chain. Every person in the part of the value chain needs to understand the importance of their job. It's not myself and me alone. I manufacture, I give it to the transporter, my work is over. The transporter takes it, dumps it in the factory, my work is over. No. Every person is responsible for the whole process. With that paradigm, one has to think. That's a new management aspect. So today, people have to think global. My delivering this particular lecture to you, friends, is reaching to so many students of different age groups, different nationalities who are listening to me. So do I have to keep that in mind and then talk to you? The answer is yes. Do I have to really do a bit of a research to understand who could be the probable audience who could be listening to me in the future? Answer is yes. So whatever we guys do today, can we think in the overall picture? Could we think as my task as a part of the larger framework? That's the first understanding to know how the JIT works. The first view of JIT is as a form of production scheduling and inventory management, whereby the products are produced to meet actual demand and materials for each stage of the production are received or produced just in time for use in the next stage of the production or for the delivery to the customer. This definition is called as little JIT. I can use a JIT in a very micro context. A classroom, I can have a JIT. The institute may not have a JIT. When the JIT is done in small centers within the company, then it's a little JIT. But when the company itself comes out with a large, comprehensive, detailed program about a JIT, it's called as a big JIT. So there are two terminologies which have been created, little JIT and big JIT. Which works? Both work. Little JIT sets the tone for the big JIT to happen, and big JIT supports little JIT to flourish. Little JIT sets the tone for the bigger one to take off. So the companies can adopt one of the two ways of doing it. Either they can go for a big JIT and implement it throughout in every part of the organization, or they may take one critical area where JIT is going to be experimented. They'll try it out there with good amount of training, and then the JIT, once it works, then they start spreading it to other units, and then they can create a philosophy of JIT, right? So little JIT or big JIT, the philosophy is the same. How well we are understanding the production, the wastage, etc., 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 right? So taking it further, the other view of JIT, as I told you, is a big JIT, which I'm talking about now, is as a revolutionary approach to manufacture by Japanese firms, in which the entire way of the products are designed, work is organized, and responsibilities are assigned is changed drastically, and a constant striving for improvement and elimination of waste is instilled. This approach to manufacture is referred to as a big JIT. It's an overall process for the whole organization. It's a policy, it's a philosophy, it's a behavioral training itself. What I've been taking for granted as housekeeping, I have to rethink. I keep my table shabby, but I know what I'm doing. That's not enough. I have to keep my table clean. So there are different types of quality norms, housekeeping, things that are 5S and all that. So they tell you how to train yourself. So your whole thinking process is trained into a different thinking. That's a modern management, wherein the way you think yesterday, if you did what you do, then you get the same results. If I have to get newer results, stay competitive and global, I need to change my thinking. So at the heart of a JIT introduction lies a behavioral training itself. How well people are adapted to looking at their jobs from the macro angle. Very important. Right? The essence of big JIT is eliminate waste. Very important things to be understood. Eliminate waste. Okay? And speed up changeovers. Work closely with suppliers. Streamline the work of flow of work. Use flexible resources. Pay attention to quality. Expose problems and use work teams to solve problems. All typically the way JIT works. Eliminate waste. We have to eliminate waste and keep it as minimum as possible. Waste cannot be eliminated to zero, but they can be kept as minimum as possible. Speed up the changeovers. Changeover meaning a machine is manufacturing a certain product and of a certain dimension, and then we are changing over to another product with a new dimension. So we have to unload, we have to set the machine all over again. That's called the changeover. Now usually the changeover takes a long time. So now we come across, if we have to stay competitive and global, then we must have speedy changeovers. That means quickly this should be removed and the new one has to be installed properly. Okay? Work closely with suppliers. There was a time when suppliers were kept at a distance. Supplier is given a drawing and he is asked to give a sample. We test the sample. If everything is okay, come out to the mass delivery. So the supplier used to be kept at bay. And very minimal contact. He's a vendor and I am a purchaser, period. The involvement was not much. Right? Streamline the flow of work. Within the organization, the flow of work, what's going around. What we call it in production as throughput. So that everything is going on in a very smooth way without interruption. Streamlining. Right? Using flexible resources. If A doesn't work, can I use B? Can I use D? Now, when we talk about the conventional manufacturing processes, they have created some designs, they have created certain processes, certain steps, and they have to be adhered to. Not that they have not to be adhered to here, they have also to be adhered to here. But within the framework, there's a flexibility that is allowed and that is encouraged. If a certain service has to be given, delivered at 5 p.m., and a certain service executive is absent, he's not there at the time, who is servicing that particular customer all throughout? Does the service stop? The answer is no. So if he is not there, if A is not there, then B takes over and flexibly gives a service to the customer. Today it is very common. It wasn't the case some years back, 2 or 3 decades back, it wasn't the case. The concerned person is not there, so the service stops. You go to some banks in the past, the person is absent today, so he doesn't, there's no service, you have to go home. No, he's not come. That doesn't work anymore. Right? The attitude itself has changed. You may be free today, but your colleague must have been gone on leave. And the colleague's work you may have to do today because, you know, it's a question of the customer. It's a paradigm shift, it's a change in the way we work today. Right? Pay attention to quality, very important. Expose problems and use work teams to solve problems. Expose problems is very important because when problems come, people have the habit of putting them under the carpet. You know, there's been an encouragement about, you know, give me the good news and keep the bad news. So many juniors I've seen, they only talk about the good news to the boss, sometimes wrong news also. They try to please. And that comes with a lot of fear, threat and other behavioral issues. Now, when there's a problem in a JIT, report it there and then and solve it. The problem is addressed, not the person. So these are centric to the processes, not to the person. So there's a lot of shift in the way one looks at it. Right? And then work in teams. Today we work in teams. Nobody's a commando or an island. I cannot do anything alone. I cannot deliver this lecture if I'm alone. I need a team around me. They are supporting me to make this thing happen. So we work in teams. Right? And when we're working in teams, I need to have a harmony and effectiveness and respect for each other. It's very important. And this is a paradigm shift that's happening today with the workforce globally. Take it or leave it, it's come to stay. So the earlier each of us understands that we are globally connected, that we are globally requiring each other, the better it will be for us. We'll understand the larger picture. Otherwise, if we start looking parochially, regionally, country-wise, and you start looking at each of us separate from the others, then we cannot really be effective in what we do. While it is important to have my own identity, I need to also respect the other person's identity and mix with him and deliver it to him. This is the way it operates. Right? And so, taking it further, there's a term called lean production that's in vogue. Lean production. So this term lean production was first used by three gentlemen, Womack, Jones and Roos, in their landmark study of the automobile industry in a book titled The Machine That Changed the World. Highly recommended. Please read it. It's got a lot of things which are very differently looked at as compared to the conventional way of manufacturing. So they coined a terminology called lean manufacturing, lean production. And nowadays firms speak about going lean, lean manufacturing, lean retailing, and lean supply chains. When we say lean means what is necessary, you just do that, nothing more, nothing less. If you have six people to do some job, keep them as six. Don't unnecessarily engage people. Don't make them less than six. There are various aspects to lean. The lean manufacturing or the lean production is always hand in glove with JIT. Whenever I talk about a JIT is not possible unless and until there's a lean production. These two come hand in hand, right?